Morning, everyone. Happy Buddha's birthday. And I'll say something probably a little later about this image, statue, rupa of the baby Buddha that is in front of me. You can all see it probably. He is standing in a bowl of scented water, scented with gardenia flowers. So what is our relationship, those of us here, mostly in Florida, some in other parts of the country, maybe a few from different parts of the world, all joined by the boundarylessness of the internet, so to speak. What is our relationship in the year 2020? Modern peoples with a mindset, cultural set, economic, the whole thing. So radically different than the world of northern India. It's now sort of southern Nepal, approximately 2,600 years ago. What connects what we're doing here in the Florida Community of Mindfulness to this event? Well, the most obvious answer is it is only because of that event that we are here. In our historical age and in our world, Buddhism and everything that Buddhism encompasses has become, as it was embraced over the centuries by hundreds and hundreds of millions of people in various cultures, times, and ages. It's important that we remember that Buddhism and all its different lineages and traditions and began with one person. And that one person, just like us, was a baby, began as a baby. And so what the human being, the man that we, that was became called the Buddha, began his life born into a small little principality in what was northern India, now is almost to the border of northern India, but it's in Nepal. In Nepal. Born to a, in that little principality, born to a noble family, whatever that meant at the time. Certainly was not the palaces and the grandeur of what we, when we think about France or England, that nobility, much simpler, smaller scale. And so he was born to a mother and a father. Father was the king or one of the chief nobles or chieftain, you know, various interpretations of that principality. We know he was born, there were kind of more mythological ideas around his conception, not unlike other religious founders. But we do know that he was physically born to his mother, Queen Maya. Maya. And by the way, she died 8 or 9 days after his birth. And part of the reason supposedly she died, all mothers of a child that is destined to be a Buddha dies early on. And because it would break their hearts, it is said, to have their child leave home. So to prevent that brokenheartedness, traditionally it is said that the mothers exit this world. But actually she went to a very beautiful Tushita heaven, one of the heavenly realms, and actually later in life, when he was the Buddha, it is said he went there. Mounted the staircase and went there and taught his mother the Dharma and liberated her. So even though we know there is just in the historical mention, the dimension the Buddha was born, he was an infant, but in the more mythological dimension, it is said that he came out of his mother fully formed. As you can, if those of you, I don't know how well you can see this little statue, but he looks like a little boy. And they actually have him in the statue looking like a Buddha with this special curly kind of hair and fully formed. And miraculously, he took immediately upon entering the world, he was able to walk. You know, interesting, thinking about it now. I mean, a lot of animals actually. Right after they're dropped, you've probably seen pictures of horses and deer and, you know, other animals. Right after they give birth, they do take to their feet and walk. So, you know, the idea that he did was certainly unusual in the human realm, but not so unusual. So anyhow, he walked, and supposedly he took 7 steps. And as his foot touched the earth, each step, a lotus grew. And after he had taken 7 steps, he stopped and he took this pose. I don't know if you can see it. The right hand is up like this and the left hand is down like this. And he is pointing. He's pointing up and he's pointing down. And there was nobody to record the event. So we only have what has been passed down. But basically he said something to the effect, above the heavens, below the earth, I am the only one. So we'll come back to this in a few minutes so we understand this better. So this is significant because the Buddha that we know would have not been in our lives if a baby hadn't been born. And supposedly at the birth of a child, very traditionally in India, even till today, an astrologer would be called in. A seer would be called in to kind of cast the horoscope. And what the seer said was basically, this child is destined, again, putting aside this miraculous 7 steps in the statement for the moment, but he basically said, yeah, this child has a very wondrous chart. He will be a great being. He will either be a great leader of human beings in this world as a world leader, sort of like a king, or he will renounce the world and be a Buddha, kind of a Dharma king, so to speak. there are these two paths that are seen in his chart. The king, very upset at hearing this because he wanted his son to be his heir, decided that he would do everything he could to keep his son in a very kind of a bubble, a very worldly bubble, where only the pleasures of life would be known to him. So he would be very comfortable and attracted and attached to the worldly life, so he would never think of renouncing the world and following a different path. So it is important to understand that in kind of the human unfolding of this young baby boy's life, he followed a path very much like other, we might say, sons of nobility that were very spoiled. But supposedly he was never spoiled, but he was spoiled in the sense that he had a life of great ease. He did all the things. He hunted and he played sports and he socialized and he had all the good things. He had a very healthy body, a strong body. He had pleasure, you know. Eventually he had an arranged marriage, he had a son. It all looked very good for this young man. He was happy and content in his worldly life. And some of us could imagine if we had only known pleasure and support and love and all the good things and had enough of all the worldly things, we too might be very happy, all of us. If we had never known discomfort or things. So it's very important to understand that the Buddha's life is understandable. But one of the conditions that his father had kind of put on him was to keep him within the grounds of the palace and only around palace people. Because again, the king was very aware of this prophecy. And he did not want his son to renounce the world. He wanted him to be very attached to the world. So he kept him very isolated. Again, in a very protective cocoon. Perhaps many of us would love to be in that cocoon. Maybe this quarantine at home is sort of like that, to put us in a cocoon. So no toxic things get to us. So that's what the king was up to. But at some point in his 20s, the Buddha became a little curious about what was on the other side of the palace walls. So he kind of finagled his servant, his charioteer, to take him outside the palace to kind of see what was going on out there. And there were these series of excursions that really his name was Siddhartha, shook him up. Because he saw somebody sick. Well, he didn't even know he was sick. He just saw somebody that didn't look very good. They were pale and they were sneezing and coughing and, you know, seemed very depleted. And he had to ask his charioteer, you know, what is that? Who is that? And the charioteer very just say, oh, I mean, that's just a sick person. And the Buddha goes, what? That's a rare thing. Never seen anything like that. And the charioteer says, oh, no, everybody gets sick. So that was quite kind of challenging, because he had not known that the bodies get sick, look so terrible. Another on a journey, he off the palace, he saw, perhaps he saw somebody like me, you know, with gray hair and wrinkles and, you know, not in the full bloom of youth. Actually, in descriptions, probably a little worse than me. They were kind of bent over and hobbling and, you know, very weak. And again, the Buddha said he'd never seen anything like that. He'd only seen healthy people. You know, what is that? And the Buddha and his charioteer said, well, that's just that's an old person. And the Buddha said, what? You know, I've never seen anything like that. Very rare. And the charioteer said, no, it's very common. Everybody gets like that. All bodies not only get sick, they decay. They decay means they get aging. They look, they're, you know, bodies decay. And again, this was very upsetting to the Buddha because, you know, he just felt very strong and healthy and he thought it would just go on forever like this. He had not bargained in his protective bubble for sickness and old age. Sort of beginning to get a sense that this story is not so different than our own. And then on the third excursion out, he came across in India, still to today, it's very common. You see people carrying a dead person to the, you know, through the streets to the cremation grounds. And he saw this dead person. Oftentimes they're covered with flowers or different things, but their faces, you know, the dead face is very out there. And so he saw this. He saw this funeral procession. And once again, he has a charioteer, you know, what is that? And who is that? Again, very, like some rare occurrence. Again, the charioteer said, that's just a, you know, a dead person. And the Buddha said, well, you know, what? Common? And the charioteer said, yes, everybody. Everybody that is born dies. So, you know, he had been thrown by a sickness. He had been thrown by aging. But he was really totally thrown by death. But not only is this there this deterioration of the human body, but that it comes to an end, that all human life comes to an end. There's a finality. There's no coming back from. And the charioteer explained to him what death was. There's no coming back from. And so that really threw the Buddha into a profound existential crisis, we would say. Because the whole basis of his life was a life of pleasure and enjoyment and good health. And, you know, he enjoyed his wife, he enjoyed his children, he enjoyed his things. And the idea that sort of everything, all the people in his life and his body and all his, I mean, his power, his status, none of it lasted. And that he would eventually just exit all of it. Again, kind of, probably these days we would say he became profoundly depressed. But not like a clinical depression, more like an existential depression when he sort of kind of understood kind of the ultimate meaninglessness of his life. But luckily, he was saved from a life of clinical depression by his fourth encounter, which was he saw walking on one of them as he kept going out, he saw a shramanera at that time, sort of an ascetic, someone who had renounced the world, which was common within the Vedic culture of that time. And this man was walking barefoot, as were many, but a very simple robe, just a bag. And he was walking with a great serenity and peace. And of course, the Buddha said, well, you know, who's that? And again, his charioteer explained, oh, this is a charioteer. He's someone who has renounced the world. He has left home. He has devoted himself to spiritual meditative cultivation. So the Buddha was very struck that in the midst of this fundamental existential crisis and meaninglessness of life, he saw somebody who had renounced all the pleasures of life, had renounced all the activities of worldly life, and seemed to be very calm and had a great presence to him. So again, this was very, very meaningful. It kind of saved him from either a life that could have been a life of depression and meaninglessness, or a life of hedonism. Well, I'll just, you know, throw myself into life and just get as much pleasure as I can get, even though I know it's going to come to an end and I'm going to get sick and I'm going to die and I'm going to get old and it's all going to deteriorate. I'll just grab as much pleasure as I can. So to the hedonistic path, the other path with the nihilistic path, life is meaningless, kind of just depressed. So he dwelled on this a while in the palace, and more his life in the palace sort of appeared more and more meaningless to him in the context of sickness, old age, and death and permanence, and in the context of seeing that there was another way. So we know that that crisis was resolved for him. It may not be resolved for you and I, but was resolved for him by leaving home. He had to resolve this himself. He had to find some profound meaning to life to justify existence. And he knew it was not found within the confines of his life in the palace, the confines in his householder's life. So he left home. Many people, I think Asians understood this better, Westerners go, oh, he left his wife and child, you know, it's sort of like desertion or something. Please understand, you know, very different context. Families were much more extended families. Everybody took care of each other. You know, his son and wife were well taken care of. They still had many, many supportive relations. He did not desert them in that sense. And so then, like many of us, he went on a spiritual search. And for 5 years, he basically sought out and studied with many of the leading teachers of his time and age in his geographical area. And there were many famous teachers with communities around them, and he went and studied with them. And we were told that he actually mastered their meditative traditions. They were probably primarily meditative traditions that were based on cultivating, we might say, trance states, meditative states of deep, deep oceanic bliss, that were primarily based on cutting oneself off from all the sensations of the five senses, cutting oneself off from the thinking mind, and just in a little bit of a trance state, dwelling deeply in these meditative trance states. And so he sought out different teachers, he mastered their teaching, but still felt that the fundamental question that had moved him was not resolved, because what he understood, and this is very important to understand, he realized that this ultimate calmness and peace of mind that he achieved through these meditative trances, meditative states, were not permanent. They sort of lasted sort of as long as the experience. But when he came back kind of out of the meditative trance, out of the meditative experience, he still felt a sense of separation, a sense of disconnection. And sort of would find that a lot of this kind of disconnection, this kind of selfhood that he had lost in the meditative trance, that had fallen away as the self disappeared and duality disappeared and he just dwelled in this oneness, came back. We might say his meditation experiences were state specific. And again, I would say there are many people listening to this call who understand exactly the Buddha's experience, maybe not as profound, but we may find that within the context of our meditation, our single point of concentration meditation, to one degree or another, we may achieve a certain level of calmness, a certain level of peace, a certain level of not feeling so separate from, even a sense of connection to something bigger than ourself. That is not unknown. And yet we often find that when we return to life, return to relationship, return to family, return to work, return to the world, it all starts up over again. So this was the Buddha's experience in 2,600 years ago. So he was not, he forsake the meditative path. And another very common path in those days was asceticism, austerities. That this was the path to just kind of transcend the body, transcend duality by basically, you know, transcending the body by sort of engaging in practices that really were comfortable, harmful, painful to the body, that if one got beyond all of that, one would achieve some kind of enlightenment. So the Buddha, with I think four or five other practitioners that he had become friendly with along the way, they went on their own and decided they would follow the ascetic path. And they went through all the austerities of the time, culminating on, I believe he was eating one grain of rice a day. And there are there are images of Shakyamuni, well, Siddhartha, he wasn't called Shakyamuni then, as the ascetic. And if you've ever seen images of him sitting in the meditation posture, face incredibly gaunt, you can see his ribs, you can see his rib cage, eye sockets deeply, his eyes are deeply in the sockets. It's all just skin and bone. And he's got a beard, you know, he's an ascetic. He doesn't cut his hair. This is the ascetic Buddha. And so he reached the point where, again, and he supposedly he was near death, and he remembered. This is very interesting. You know, we have our, mind-seeking way talks that people are doing, and oftentimes each of us remember, even as children, there was a different sensibility within us, a different kind of knowing, even in the midst of all that was going on, something else called to us. And what the Buddha remembered was an experience. I think when he was a young teenager, when he'd been involved at a harvest, I can't remember, it was a planting ceremony, when ceremonially the king and the religious people and all the people would go out into the fields to bless them, and they would start the turning over the soil, plowing the soil for planting. And he saw, as the oxen were going through the fields, drawing the plows and treading with their big feet, that as they were doing that, and it was very hot, and he was sitting under a tree, as they were doing that, he could see that, you know, little rodents, little mice, insects, all different kinds of little life forms were being killed by the plow and the oxen. And just the whole ambience, sort of on his own, he kind of left all that and went into kind of a deep meditative state on his own, where within that whole matrix of the day and the heat and the plowing and the animals moving and the dying, somehow it was all resolved in some kind of deep, knowing, meditative state. And at near death, he remembered that moment. And oh, it was like, oh, that's what I'm looking for. Not this near-death experience from starving himself. So it's very interesting. It's sort of, and I think all of us, it's a very important thing to remember, that there is a place within us that knows another way. And we may not have the profound samadhi experience of the Buddha or Siddhartha at the time, but something that calls us back from often the worldly path that we have been following. And the thing that struck him was that experience predated all his spiritual meditative practices, ascetic practices. He had just done it naturally. So he decided that he wasn't going to follow the ascetic path anymore. It wasn't getting him anywhere. Well, it was getting him just more and more miserable and near death. When he announced it to his ascetic brothers, they were very upset, kind of turned their backs on him like he had wimped out. And then he was on his own. And he basically, we know, luckily, he was found by a young girl who, Sujata, who saw him there, sitting under a tree by the river, and brought him a bowl of curd, kind of cow's milk and rice milk. Very common dish among the peasants. And slowly, Siddhartha began to gain strength again. And when he was strong enough, he decided that he would resolve all his spiritual questions, all his doubts, all his, by simply looking deeply within his own mind. He had been through all the practices to stabilize and concentrate, calm. You know, he had been through all the practices. They were the basis. But now he was just going to look deeply within, deeply introspect into his own mind. And that process of inward introspection, deep inward introspection and questioning and looking deeper into the nature of his own mind, his nature of his own experience, resulted in a profound awakening, enlightenment, liberation. In that moment, those moments during the course of a whole night, he deeply penetrated into the very nature of all existence, the nature of mind, the nature of reality, and everything became clear to him. You know, he said, the veil has completely fallen away. The house of self has completely broken down. Everything is wide and vast. But there was a great knowing. He now knew the nature of reality, the nature of life. And all the questions about birth and death and impermanence have been completely resolved for him. And for many weeks, he was in a state of bliss, place of freedom, liberated from all suffering, enlightened to the true nature of things. And I won't go into it too much, but other than to say eventually, after some doubt about whether anybody would be interested in what he'd discovered, knowing that worldly people like us, perhaps, we're very busy. We have a lot going on in our life, don't we? Very busy with our careers, earning a living, busy with our families, busy with our to-do lists, you know, lots to do. And so he thought to himself, yeah, they're very busy in their worldly life. Who would be interested in what I've discovered. Fortunately, there are various versions, but he was convinced by others, a few others, that he met along the way that, yeah, there were people in the world where the dust of the world lies light upon their eyelids. Their eyelids are not heavily encrusted with worldliness. They're encrusted, but it's light, so their eyes can be opened. So it was because of that that the Buddha decided he would teach. As we know, he went to Sarnath the first, not too far away from Bodh Gaya, where he became enlightened, and found his five ascetics, who initially were going to turn their back on him, but could tell that he was different. He had changed. There was something in his radiance, in his being. And that's where he began. He taught the Eightfold Path. He taught the Four Noble Truths. He taught non-self in Sarnath. And then began the journey. Next 40, 45, 49 years, he taught. Wandered about northern India in that geographic area. Again, I won't share with that today. But basically, the Buddha's teachings that we have today are all based on his 49 years of teaching. He taught monks, he taught nuns, he taught lay people, he taught kings, queens, he taught. Basically, he wandered, he taught anybody who came to him. And the sutras, the basic teachings of the Buddha, are the eventual writing down of what he taught. The Dharma. The Buddha taught the Dharma. And the Sangha were the people who, the community that practiced around him, monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen. So, we are here today because of that. And that began with the birth of a baby. Again, that baby, let me come back to those seven steps and that seemingly egoistic statement, above the heavens, below the earth, I am the only one. That I is not the I of self. That I is a capital, it's a big I. It's the I of the Buddha nature. The eye of oneness. The eye that has no distinguishing marks at all. It is a label for that. And so what is being said there is that from birth, even as a baby, Siddhartha had Buddha nature. He was Buddha nature. He came into this world with Buddha nature. And you know who else came into this world with their original Buddha nature? All of us did. Every one of us did. We were not fortunate to have that awareness at birth that we could pronounce it. And again, if we were to believe the story, the Buddha, even though he said that, had that knowledge at birth, it got covered over by his worldly life, just like us. Our Buddha nature, our true nature, original nature, natural and pure nature, pristine nature. It's gotten covered over. For many of us, so covered over, we're not even aware of it. We're so ensnared by the world, worldliness, by our thoughts about the world. So why is the Buddha so important? Why is the fact that a Buddha was born into a world system? Because in his own life, by his own journey, he demonstrates that a human being just like us, with eyes and ears and nose and mouth, with a mind just like ours, can, by following a spiritual path, be liberated from our suffering and attain an enlightenment. The light can go on to know the true nature of reality, of things, of who and what we are. That opening, that bringing that knowledge, that experience, through his own experience, into this world is considered very important. Because up to that point, even though there were all kinds of spiritual systems in India and teachers, no one had had, well, according to Buddhism, had had that full realization. And not only did the Buddha have the full realization, but he had this capacity to teach it. Right? Which is quite wondrous. And he taught it for a long time. He taught it for 49 years. And he had gathered around him a wonderful body of students, very developed in the practice. And because they lived, I mean, he lived with his students. He wasn't off in some remote place. They lived together very openly. They wandered together. They walked together. The Buddha was totally open. He taught every day. He taught whoever came. He responded to all the questions of his students day after day for 49 years. So the fact that he did that, and it was so comprehensive, and that he had so many awakened disciples, that even after his passing, there was a great solidity of experience and knowledge that had come from him to his students. And so we find that 2,600 years later, we have two kinds of transmission. One, his teachings were eventually, within a few centuries, written down. And so we had kind of this written body of knowledge of the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha's way, the things he taught, the way he taught. But also, because he left behind him many enlightened disciples who had come to realization of the truth of the Buddha, that we had a body of teachers that were able to pass on not only the knowledge base and the practice of the Buddha, but actually pass on the realization to their students. And it has been that transmission for 2,600 years of not only the preservation of the Dharma by the Sangha, but the realization of the Dharma, the practice of the practices of the meditation. And in every generation, people who have reaped the fruits of practice, that has been transmitted right to our time. So, traditionally in Buddhism, we are incredibly grateful for the Buddha. Because it all began with him. He is the one who had his great enlightenment stated, wonder of wonders, wonder of wonders, in this 5'6" body. Is this incredible Buddha mind, this original mind that was never tainted, never contaminated by all the worldliness that I've gone through. Totally, it's stainless as ever. This was his great discovery. We probably would have not been able to discover this for ourselves, if we're honest. So that is why we are incredibly grateful that Siddhartha did what he did. He lived the life he lived. He came to realization. He became a Buddha, an enlightened one. And that he was willing not just to hide away somewhere and enjoy the bliss of his own realization. You know, sort of, well, now I've done it. I fulfilled myself spiritually. Maybe I can retire to Florida and just enjoy myself. It's quite beautiful down there. Take up golf and tennis. You know, I mean, why don't I just enjoy life? Go to the beach. I mean, he could have done that. But he didn't do that. He thought of us. And so he tirelessly, without any remuneration, I mean, he lived by begging. Totally dependent on others. He gave up all his wealth and everything when he left the palace status. And so because of that, and because generation after generation for 2,600 years, there have been great teachers and masters who not only have mastered the teachings, come to their own realization, but taught in ways that have made the teachings of the Buddha relevant for their time, for the people, for what people were going through historically. It is because of that that we have this incredible body of practice and teaching that has come down to us to today. So those of us here in the Florida Community of Mindfulness, this is our connection. A profound connection to this baby. This is why Buddhists, and if you look, if you go to Wikipedia or something, you'll probably see that in different Buddhist countries, different Buddhist traditions, they celebrate in different ways on different days, but yet it's significant. And perhaps for many people, it's just become ritual, but it's profoundly meaningful. That, and I think it's important, as most of us are new Buddhists, that we understand the significance of what the Buddha did and its relevance to us. And, you know, because without that, not only would we not be here, but this awareness of a path to enlightenment, that's what the Buddha taught. He didn't just teach the enlightened state. He very concretely taught the path, the how to do it, the step by step. And that, again, is still, you know, that's what we're doing here in the Florida Community of Mindfulness. We are following the Buddha's teachings, how it's been passed down through many, many generations. We are following the path of liberation and enlightenment, liberation from suffering, enlightenment to the true nature of things. This is our path. So eventually, after 49 years of teaching, even though he was a fully enlightened being and had benefited so many people of all kinds, because he was incarnated in a body that was prone to sickness, old age, and death. The Buddha aged. He became older and weaker. His body did, not his mind. And he began to be sick. And eventually he died, his body died, his parinirvana. He passed completely into nirvana. Because, you know, even if one has an enlightened mind, when one is carrying around a body, you know, As the Buddha said, you've heard me say, the Buddha called the body a magnet for sickness, a magnet for disease. You know, living through the time of the pandemics, we see how clearly how these bodies just attract viruses. How there are many kinds of things in the unseen world of germs and viruses and God knows what. You know, they simply see us as a host. We are a host. You know, they couldn't care about who we think we are, what we do. We are just a host for them to continue to live. So eventually the body aged. It got sick. And so eventually the Buddha entered Parinirvana. He left behind that which was a burden to him, had become a burden to him, his body, and entered Nirvana, a state of mind that is completely free of all duality, all suffering, all discrimination. He returned home, dwelling totally within his original mind. Just before his passing, when it was clear that he was dying, some of his closest disciples, being human beings, perhaps, they were sad. They were sad. They were losing their the most special person in their life. They were losing their spiritual father, the one who had shown them all the way in this life, how to lead an awakened life. And even though most of them had been practicing for decades and decades with him, the thought that he was about to leave them made them very sad. And the Buddha, he saw them there. And he said, it was sort of like, a little bit of a remonstration. He said to them, you know, I've held back nothing. He said, very famous. I've taught all we with an open, I haven't held back anything. I've given you my complete teachings. Passing is my physical being. Don't be attached to my physical being, my physical presence. I bequeath you the Dharma. Unstintingly, for 49 years, I have taught Dharma. Each of you I have taught the way of understanding and compassion. And I've taught unceasingly. Impermanence, sickness, old age, and death. I'm sure he was a little taken aback that they were kind of getting a little sad at his death, since he felt he had prepared them for it his whole teaching life. And yet, they were sad. And if you see paintings of the Buddha's passing, oftentimes you see him under these sala trees, these two trees, and he's laying on his side, his right side, hand underneath his head, stretched out, feet together. The flowers from the sala tree are falling on him. And nearby, you see some of his major disciples, and they're downcast in the images. They're sad. Some are weeping. They're sort of covering their heads with their robe. Even some of his greatest disciples were sad, crying at his part. Even though in the truest sense there is no birth, there is no death, there is no coming, there is no going. And yet, in the world of appearances, something very meaningful had appeared to them. Something very meaningful had been part of their life. And knowing that it was coming to an end, they were sad. So, traditionally, in the Buddhist tradition, sort of has come up, on the Buddha's birthday, images of the baby Buddha are brought out from the temple storerooms, and they are put in a public space, and people who want bathe the baby Buddha. It's kind of an offering, a very traditional offering. Sort of the way, you know, when we want to be fresh, we bathe. We bathe the baby. They're fresh. And to bathe the Buddha is sort of like an offering of the purity of water. Water is symbolic often of our true nature. It is clear. It's there, but it's translucent. You can see right through it. It is fresh. It gives life, it supports life, water. And yet water can take any shape, any form. It just flows, just like our true nature. So for those of you who have been part of our community in the past, traditionally at this point, we invite the children who are here, been in their own program, doing their own thing. They've come into the hall, they come up, we invite them to bathe the baby Buddha. And then we invite everybody in the hall to bathe the baby Buddha. Today, there are only four of us in the hall. Of course, things are changing. It could be in the future, near future, far future, intermediate future, we don't know. We will be back together again in the flesh. But today there are four of us in the hall, myself, Bill, Angie, Maria Teresa. And so I invite them, all of us, on behalf of the community. So imagine as you see us bathe the Buddha that you're bathing the Buddha. So we will bathe the Buddha now, make an offering of scented water. The water is in this larger bowl and there are gardenias in it. Please consider that you all, through us, bathe the baby Buddha. Showing your appreciation and our connection to this great tradition. For those of you, you know, there are some police out there who may be monitoring us. Everyone here in the hall has sanitized their hands, and we all are keeping social distance. History, just. Let me just, you know, this is sort of like an afterword. The Buddha was an historical person. It's very interesting, just very quickly, that because Buddhism had essentially died out in India, but even though it was in all around Asia, but since all the places associated with the Buddha and his physical was in India, many Westerners, you know, this is going back 16th, 17th, 18th century, now, of course, every Asian Buddhist understood that the Buddha was a real person, and you know, but many Westerners thought maybe this is kind of a mythological. The Buddha is a mythological because, you know, all these Asian countries, they're all Buddhist countries, but they say Buddha came from India, but there's no Buddhism in India, so they wondered, and it really was the British, and the British Archaeological Society, that were able to uncover and to uncover the actual historical evidence of the Buddha. And the way they did that, there was records, there was this 2 centuries after the death of Parinirvana of the Buddha, there was a great Indian king, Ashoka, who had great convert to Buddhism. In those days, Buddhism was still very widely practiced in India. And people knew where all these places were, where the Buddha was born, where Lumbini, where he was born, and where his family's palace was, and where he lived, and where he became enlightened, and Sarnath, and where he taught, and where he taught the Rajgir. I mean, all these places were still known, and people were still practicing and living there. There were monasteries. And so what Ashoka did, he erected these pillars in all the major places associated with the Buddha that commemorated what had happened there. This was like 2 centuries afterwards. It's sort of like, we erect a pillar at Mount Vernon or something, where George Washington lived, and then over the centuries, the house could burn down, all burned down, but there was this pillar. So the Archaeological Society was able to find these places and dig them up. And lo and behold, what did they find? The pillars in Lumbini. They found the Ashokan pillar that said, in the ancient scripts, this is where the Buddha, this is where Queen Maya gave birth to the Buddha in Kapilavastu. This is where the, this is the palace. And Bodh Gaya, this is where the Buddha came to full enlightenment. And Sarnath, this is where. So all the major places associated with the Buddha that are in all the sutras and everything were found. And if any of you ever go to India, as many of us have, or some of us have in this community, you can go on pilgrimage and you can go to all these places because many of them have now been reclaimed. One, as travel to India is much easier than it was centuries ago. So many Buddhists throughout the world now make pilgrimage to these places, as well as there is a growth of Buddhism once again in India. So there is care from it, as well as since independence, Indians themselves have begun to establish a relationship again with Buddhism. So I just wanted to add that historical note about the that the Buddha was a real person.